the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, welcome back. Though this must be a bittersweet time for you, as despite your best efforts to keep it together with the masking tape and pipe cleaners, you've had to abandon the Shimizu bandwagon on the side of the road.
Nah, there's no abandoning it. We'll get this running. We've still got 1 week left to save it. It's not looking great, is it? But yeah, my running repairs didn't work, so I'll have to work extra hard this week to try and make some sort of last gasp miracle. But yeah, it's looking pretty horrendous for Shimizu at the moment.
Indeed, as you say, they're down to their final roll of the dice next weekend. And yes, in the second last round of matches, as you'd expect, there was a drama galore at both ends of the J1 table. And joining us this week to round it all up is a very familiar voice for J-Talk listeners, but we haven't heard too much from him on Big Pod this season. It's Sean Carroll. Sean, welcome back to the pod, and how are you?
Thanks a lot, mate. Yeah, might not be that recognisable a voice, seeing as I've got a bit of a cold. I'm lying in bed with some ginger and lemon. So yeah, I'm doing well, and fighting through for the Big Pod and for the J League, the good of the J League. Yeah,
terrific stuff. Great to have you back, Sean. So yes, you're at the Nissan Stadium on Saturday to potentially see Yokohama F. Marinos raise the shale as a J1 champions, as that ultimately did not eventuate. That's cleared the runway for us to lead this podcast with breaking news. Sam, we're quite lucky in this instance. Of course, it usually happens the morning after we record, but on Monday afternoon, Urawa Reds notified the world that they will not be renewing their contract with Ricardo Rodriguez for the 2023 season. We'd heard rumours of this in recent weeks, but I must say it's still taken me by surprise, as I say, when the news broke on Monday afternoon.
Yeah, it's interesting that they decided to not wait until the end of the season. Then you've also got this Asian Champions League final that you think, does he deserve to guide them through to that one? It's like an awkward position, isn't it, right at the start of next season. So they had to kind of make a decision before then which direction they want to go in. I think this season has been really poor for Reds, so you can understand why the decision has been made. There were signs the previous season that it was coming together. They were working okay after a bit of a dodgy start, but this season, other than a good spell in the middle, it's been relatively poor. And I mean, the weekend game against Yokohama kind of summed up the way that it's gone. It is a surprise, I suppose, but yeah, I can see why they've made that decision. But the replacements are not necessarily leaving anything to be desired.
Yeah, well, we're going to leave the pronunciation of the German fella to you a little bit later on, Sam. But what do you make of it, Sean? As I said, there were rumours floating around, but it's still taken me a little bit by surprise. Rodriguez came in, won the Emperor's Cup in his first season, and as Sam said, he's led them to the final of the Asian Champions League in his second. But there can be no denying that their league form was pretty poor for the most part of this season. So how are you taking the news, all things told? Are you surprised? Do you think he deserved another season, or are Reds right in acting as they have?
I wouldn't say I'm surprised, no. I think ideally I tend to be one that thinks managers should be given time to work and to build a squad in their image, and I prefer them to kind of get time to see a project through. But I think the fact that they won the Emperor's Cup and have got to the ACL final is maybe a little bit misleading. I mean, the Emperor's Cup, you only have to win what, sort of 4 or 5 games. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily a sign of anything too solid being built. The ACL was, you know, they were playing all their games at home, pretty much no away fans, didn't really come up against anyone particularly strong by way of opposition until they played Jeonbuk, who had played, I think, pretty much all of Jeonbuk's games in the previous week, had gone to extra time, and they still nearly edged Red. So I think, yeah, maybe those sort of achievements, obviously, they, you know, there's still things that other coaches at Reds and a lot of other clubs hadn't been able to achieve. But I think maybe it slightly adds a bit of gloss. I think overall, yeah, the signs were kind of promising last season early on, but this season it really has looked like I guess it's kind of a cliche, but it really hasn't looked like the dressing room has been united behind him. And that sort of shone through, I think, in that Marinos game. Reds were abysmal. Just the lack of organisation, the lack of drive. I mean, I know they've got nothing to play for, but you know, if you're playing a club that big that should be aiming to win titles, hasn't won the league for far, far too long. And that, you know, the quality, if you look at individually, the quality that of player that Reds have got, there's no reason they should be that sort of that vastly outplayed by Marinos. Obviously, Marinos are, you know, we've had a fantastic season. Kevin Muscat for the kind of maybe he's not quite as popular a coach as previous managers there. But you know, you can't fault the way they've played this year and the position they're in now. But Reds should not have been, if you look at, you know, just on paper the squads, they shouldn't have been beaten that easily. So no, I'm not that surprised. I think maybe it was a case of both sides, a club and the manager, just kind of both realizing that it's probably not going to get any better from here. So yeah, maybe you know, both of them, he can leave with those sort of, you know, the Emperor's Cup medal and the fact he got them to the final. His CV isn't going to be too damaged, and maybe the club can realize, right, okay, you know, we've got the foundations here for a good team. By all accounts, the guys in charge at the club now, you know, with the recruitment they've done of the players from Europe, hasn't really worked out too well, with all of them pretty much seeming to get injured quite a bit. But it seems like they're taking a different kind of approach to how they're building the squad. So if they can bring in a manager, maybe a slightly left field appointment, Massimo Ficadenti obviously would not count as left field. If they can bring in somebody able to sort of mold the players they've got into a workable team, then yeah, maybe it's time for a change.
All right then. So Sam, I hope you've been you had your microphone muted and you've been practicing his name while Sean was speaking there. So who's the fella who might be out of left field that might be an interesting appointment for Reds if they decide to go down that alley?
Well, it would definitely be left field, but his name is Achim Bärlotzer. Generally, he's been within the RB Leipzig system. He's been a youth manager there. He's been assistant manager for a long time. He's had a couple of spells elsewhere in Germany, never too successful at Mainz and Cologne and Jahn Regensburg, but really like short stints at most of those clubs. Last time he was involved in any sort of managerial capacity was when Jesse Marsch left Leipzig and went to Leeds. It was interim manager there, and he was kind of remit was to kind of, because Jesse Marsch is such an attacking manager, he had to make them a little bit more cautious, a little bit stronger defensively. So that's kind of the way it looks like they're looking at that sort of profile of manager, if Ficadenti is the other one being linked, which is an interesting one for me, because obviously you bring in Rodriguez to play a certain style of football, an expansive, positive style of football, and it looks, if they're looking down the route of Ficadenti and Bärlotzer, then it looks like they're panicking a little bit and completely going away from that. And I'm not sure this Red squad is built in that way to really sit back and be a really tough defensive team. So yeah, I'm not convinced by the way that they're going about things. Like, there are reasons why you bring in Ficadenti, and I think Nagoya did it well in terms of they were a big club that were towards the bottom of the league. They were kind of, they'd flirted with J2, they'd been in J2, and it needed someone to come in and organise them and sort it out. And it really worked for Nagoya to a point. But for Reds, just, yeah, the quality of that team on paper should be challenging for titles, and it should be playing it in a good manner of football. And I don't think Ficadenti or Bärlotzer, if he's in a similar vein, really fits that. I think it's a weird way to go. Sean, what sort of manager would you be thinking should come in to Reds? Do you agree with looking at the Ficadenti route? I don't think so, based on what you said a little bit earlier. But yeah, is there any, well, I don't know if you've got a name in mind, or just like a type of manager that you think Reds should be looking for?
Yeah, no, I mean, certainly no names. I don't know enough about those things, certainly over in Europe. I don't watch enough, barely any European football, so I really don't know anything of that. But I think they need to stick to the same approach. I think, yeah, the squad that they've built, the type of players they've got, there's enough there that, again, we've both said a few times, but on paper, they're good enough individual talent-wise to be you know, to be challenging Marinos, Frontale, Hiroshima, Kashima up at the top. So I think, you know, it has, just because it hasn't quite come together under this manager, it doesn't mean you just abandon the whole approach. I would certainly go for another manager who wants to play football with the ball, who wants to use, you know, the attacking players that you've got and take the game to opponents. So, yeah, I don't think, you know, if you bring in someone like Ficadenti, you know, is he going to, are Reds going to suddenly be able to win the league? I don't think so. Like you said, with someone like Grampus, when you're trying to bring a team from the bottom and lift them up higher, and you need a bit of structure, I think it works. But I don't think where Reds are now, they're still likely to finish sort of upper mid-table. You need, I think, some consistency, someone to come in, reinvigorate the players, maybe get some of the players who perhaps weren't pulling in the same direction as Rodriguez, whether it was personality things, whether it was tactical nuances they didn't like, bring in someone to just kind of freshen things up that has the same approach. I don't really see the point of going back to the drawing board.
Yeah, fair enough. I wonder whether they just they gave him too many players to work with. I mean, we were impressed at the way they were able to bulk up their squad over the past 18 months or so. But you know, three foreign strikers, you know, Linson, Schalke, and Juncker, and yeah, I mean, as Sean said, a lot of them were injured for large parts of their time at the club. But yeah, it's been a I guess a bit of a hodgepodge, and yeah, Rodriguez's ideas, they haven't been properly implemented, I wouldn't say, this season. And there's a number of caveats that Red supporters might be pointing to, and a number of them, I'm sure, are disappointed at the news. But it can't be denied that they've slipped backwards this season. After a sixth place finish, they can finish no higher than seventh with one game to go. And so Saturday's final round will be Rodriguez's last in charge of Urawa. And Sean also mentioned earlier, they were pretty abject at the Nissan Stadium on Saturday afternoon before a crowd of over 46,300. As we said, a large majority of them there to hopefully see their side lift the J1 trophy. It wasn't to be, but for about half an hour in the second half on Saturday, Sean, it looked like Kobe were going to do F. Marinos a favour. F. Marinos had obviously already put their game against Reds to bed with a brace of braces from El Burr and Anderson Lopez. But could you feel the tension and the anticipation rising from the stands with that game at Todoroki ticking away and Kobe still holding Kawasaki?
To be honest, I didn't really, because the Wi-Fi is so bad in the press seats there. I wasn't really able to keep track on what was going on elsewhere. Marinos pretty much, the game was wrapped up pretty much at halftime. They were not only ahead, but just playing football on a completely different level to Reds. It would have been a huge surprise if Reds had somehow come out and found a way back into the game. No, not really. And selfishly, I was kind of hoping it wouldn't be decided on the day, because then it would have meant I'd have had to stick around for a good another hour and a half while they did all the celebrations, and then you have to sit around waiting in the bowels of the stadium for the interviews post game. Although we still had to wait quite a while for Kevin Muscat, because obviously it was their last home game of the season anyway, so they have all those shenanigans. Not really. I didn't really feel. I feel like, because Marinos have been on the cusp for like pretty much a month now. They had those two home games against teams, you know, one of whom's now been relegated in Jubilo and another in Gamba that are, you know, still in the very much in the relegation dogfight. They had those two games coming up, and it was like either of those, it looked like if they won, they could be crowned champions that day. And then obviously they lost them both. Then you had the two weekends off for the cup finals. So there was kind of that extra break. There's been a kind of, I don't know, like a sort of feeling of sort of being in limbo or stasis perhaps. And obviously because it's still in Marinos' hands, you know, it wasn't the last round of the season. It wasn't like they have to win here and hope this happens. It was kind of like, well, we've won this game, so Frontale aren't going to win the league today. And as long as we don't lose the next game, we're still champions. So yeah, there was obviously, you know, there was a period where it seemed like, you know, this could be it. Okay, they're going to decide it today. But no, it didn't really feel like, you know, there wasn't a groan going around the stands or anything when Iyanaga scored with 5 minutes to go for Frontale. It all just seemed kind of like, okay, maybe that's partly as well just because of the way that Muscat talks about the game, in the same way that Postecoglou did and Pete Klimovsky and all the people of that, you know, the cult of Ange. It's always, you know, they're always talking about how they don't look at results, they don't look at the next thing, they're just focused on the way they play. Like, you know, in a way it's commendable, because, you know, it's nice that they've got this dedication to play in a certain way, but sometimes, you know, you'd like them to show a bit of excitement, a bit of like they're really aiming to win. And obviously they do it at times, but they're so focused on the process rather than the results sometimes. So maybe there was an element of that too, just kind of like sort of seeps into the way you watch it, because you're just like, well, oh yeah, you know, they're going to win today, and then they'll focus on the next game when the next game comes.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, so Sean's mentioned it there, the break for the cup finals, and F. Marino's, their players obviously had a long time to think about those shock defeats to Iwata and Gamba that Sean's mentioned. But any fears amongst the squad or indeed amongst the support about how it was going to go against Reds, who were obviously looking to play spoilers heading into the game? Well, they were quickly wiped away by Elber's 17th minute opener. And I mean, by that stage, I mean, the die was fairly cast, wasn't it? You could see that F. Marinos were well up for this. And I guess along the lines of what Johnny said last week, Reds turned out to be the perfect opponent for F. Marinos.
Yeah, absolutely ideal, because even Reds playing at their best are going to come out and give Yokohama space to counter-attack, unlike Gamba and Jubla, who were there just to sit in and then maybe get one on the break, but it didn't really matter to them. The draw would have been okay the way that they set up, so they made it really difficult for Reds for Yokohama, but Reds kind of made it quite easy. It was in the first 15 minutes, the Reds would attack a little bit and there wouldn't be too much space for Yokohama, not really, but eventually they broke them down and got a little bit of luck with the way that the first goal comes about in the deflection to Elbert. But after that, because Reds have to come out and they're not really very disciplined, even at the best of times defensively, there was just so much space for Yokohama and they played really well. They carved Reds open time and again, but the defending from Arara was absolutely pathetic. I mean, the corners, we know that, I don't think Reds have ever defended a corner that I've ever seen, but the second goal comes from a corner that's not really cleared, and then the defending, I know it's Juncker and Isaka who are not necessarily the greatest defenders, but they just kind of allow Elbert to saunter into the area before his shot. They just rolled the red carpet out, and the same happened with the actual defenders for the third goal, in that Iwanami and Schultz, once the ball's turned over, they both need to get close to Elbert, but both just leave him such a wide gap to run through, and it was just really poor. And in those moments you can see why Reds are thinking, well, what about Ficadenti, because the defending was just that shocking. But it was absolutely ideal for Yokohama, especially once they got that first goal. Maybe if they didn't and they were at 0-0 at half time, then there'd be some concerns that would come in. But yeah, taking that early lead against Reds, it just turned into a procession for them. I thought they played very well, but helped out definitely by the opposition.
Yeah, fair enough then. So a goal apiece for Elber and Anderson Lopez in each half of the game, 2-0 at halftime. Elber made it 3-0 just before the hour, and then in the 65th minute, Lopez got his second to make it 4-0. Kasper Juncker pulled a goal back almost straight away for Reds, though Muscat and his players thought that shouldn't have counted after the ball appeared to hit Juncker's arm in the build-up in an aerial duel with Eduardo. But I think the VAR wanted to, he might have been having his afternoon tea at that stage, so he didn't want to have anything to do with that. And the goal stood for Reds, and 4-1 it finished. I guess for F. Marino's supporters, maybe just the inevitability of Kawasaki meant that the buzz wasn't too great while it remained 1-1 at Todoroki. But as we'll come on to next, Frontale ended up squeaking out a 2-1 victory to send the title race to the final day. But for F. Marinos, the equation is very simple. They need just a draw away at Kobe on the final day. Mathematically, Kawasaki could finish level on points with them if they were to win at FC Tokyo. They would need to do so by 11 clear goals. And while Frontale have definitely given Tokyo some frightful batterings at Ajinomoto Stadium over the years, 11 goals is probably a bridge too far for them, probably. But, yeah, F. Muddy Nose are bouncing back in some style. And, yes, again, it remains in their hands heading into the final round. Kawasaki hosted Kobe. Frontale, obviously, yeah, looking to keep the title race alive. And Kobe coming in on the back of five straight league victories. But just like El Burr giving F. Muddy Nose an early lead at the Nissan Stadium, Kawasaki's main man this season, Marcinho, lashed in from close range via a deflection in the 20th minute. And, well, yeah, his partner in crime this season, Akihiro Iyanaga, was to have the final say with about 5 minutes to go. But, Sean, well, yeah, it looked like Kobe definitely gave Kawasaki a game here. And, yeah, if it wasn't for a late intervention from VAR, that was 100% correct, I might add, it might, yeah, it might have ended up finishing all square at Todoroki.
Yeah, I do think... you have to give credit to Frontale for the way they have ensured that the title race does go to the last day of the season. And, you know, they have still now got, obviously, it's not a huge opportunity just because of the way that Marinos have played for most of the, you know, recent games. If you take out the two against the couple of lower league tables that sort of parked the bus and really didn't give them room to play in. The fact that Frontale have managed to take it this far, I think, is credit to them. But they have looked like they're kind of really hanging on, you know, compared to recent years where Frontale have just really dominated and looked a cut above everybody. Obviously, they've had quite a lot of injuries. Obviously, you know, losing your best player or players every season will eventually take its toll. But I think, yeah, again, they're doing what they need to just about stay within reach. And yeah, as you say, I mean, I only saw the highlights. I've only seen the replays of the incident on Twitter and things. But I mean, yeah, it looked like a penalty. It was a clumsy, you know, it was a clumsy challenge from Kobayashi. And if, you know, if it happens anywhere else on the pitch, it's a straightforward free kick. The referee doesn't have to think twice about it. So yeah, I mean, it was a penalty. Iyanaga obviously is just one of the most reliable performers in the J League right now, so yeah, he was never going to miss from the spot, although yeah, very nearly the keeper kept it out. But yeah, I think, yeah, full credit to Frontale, especially with, yeah, Kobe now seem to have, same as they did last season, at the end it's kind of found some form when it's not really worth anything. So I think, yeah, it was a good showing from Kobe again. And they'll give Marinos a good challenge on the last day. So, yeah, Marinos are still the favourites, but it's the last day of the season. Anything can happen. Pressure, you know, as well coached as players are, as much as managers will talk about the fact they know what they're doing and, you know, whatever, the pressure of the occasion can affect anyone. One mistake, a red card, something silly can change everything. You know, suddenly every minute of every game on the last day becomes so much heavier, means so much more than it does in round 15 or round 24. So, yeah, I think we're set for a pretty thrilling final weekend.
Most definitely. Yeah, it's certainly shaping up that way. So, Sam, we mentioned Marcinho scored the first for Kawasaki, and Iyanaga's penalty ultimately won it for them. But apart from those two incidents, and most of the major flashpoints in this game involved a Kobayashi or two, didn't it? Yuki Kobayashi, the midfielder from Kobe, sent in a terrific left-footed free kick from well beyond 30 yards 6 minutes into the second half to equalise for Kobe. I think we have to disappoint a few Celtic fans that might be tuning in and hoping that the Yuki Kobayashi that they're rumoured to sign, well, this is not the one that took that free kick on Saturday afternoon. So, yeah, you might have to look elsewhere for a set-piece delivery like that.
Yeah, that really confused me yesterday somewhat. A few Celtic supporters messaged me on, like, quoted a tweet after this free kick, and they were saying, well, are these rumours true? And I go, I don't think so. 30-year-old midfielder, he's done his time in Europe. I don't think he's going to Celtic. But yeah, it turned out to be the centre-back, and I don't think they should necessarily watch this game if they're looking for examples of his performances. It wasn't quite as bad as Kikuchi. He was dreadful for the first goal, and then I think he let in another Kobayashi, a new Kobayashi, fairly quickly after that. So, yeah, it wasn't a great day. They definitely want the free kick take. It was a fantastic effort. And yeah, it really gave Kobe a way back into the game, because Kawasaki, I think, had played very well, especially at the start of that second half. I thought Miki Yamane had one of his better performances this season. It just involved with everything, a lot more license to go forward, exchanging nice passes with Inaga especially. And so that's great for Japan going into the World Cup. But yeah, after Kobe equalised, there was also, I don't know if you both saw this, the Kikuchi goal that was disallowed.
I was going to come on to that, mate, yeah. This week in VAR. This week
in VAR. This week. Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think he's onside. I don't understand what they've given it for. I assume they're thinking Osaki is interfering with play, but it's, yeah, not for me. I think this was one that Kawasaki got away with. I mean, yeah, do you have any other opinion on that, or see something that I don't, which is usually the case with VAR decisions in the J-League?
Well, no, I think, yeah, they've given offside against Osaki. But, yeah, ultimately he wasn't he was kind of lurking in the area at the back of the group of players. But, yeah, he certainly didn't make a play on the ball. So the fact that, the offside was given so quickly and, play was allowed to restart so quickly means that, VAR was happy with it. But, yeah, for me, that was an unlucky one for Kobe. Obviously, for fans of the title race, we're happy because it kept the game at 1-1 and Frontale have ultimately gone on to win it. But, yeah, I think Kobe can feel hard done to there, as it did look that, yeah, Kikuchi, the man who headed in from the same Yuki Kobayashi's free kick, it looked like he was denied a perfectly legitimate goal there. So a shame for him. And as I say, it was mentioned on the DAZN highlights by the Japanese commentator that, yeah, Osaki was offside. But again, yeah, I don't think he was interfering with play. That incident came after Miki Yamane, who Sam mentioned, hit the post. And then Marcinho drew a stunning point-blank save from the young Kobe keeper Yuya Tsuboi with a header from inside the six-yard box. So a terrific save from Tsuboi. But, Frontale were finally given the chance to keep the title race going into the final game when, a pair of Kobayashis tangled on the edge of the box in the 79th minute. The other Kobe, Yuki Kobayashi, the defender, caught the Frontale striker Yu Kobayashi on the heel. Yu Kobayashi fell outside the box, but it was interesting, Sean, to see from the highlights that no penalty appeal at all by any of the Kawasaki players or Kobayashi himself. The referee set the ball for the free kick to be taken inside the D. And, while I didn't appreciate the referee giving us all the bird while he was listening to his VAR in his earpiece, I'm glad the correct decision was ultimately made. But yeah, it was a puzzling one for me to watch at the time that, as I say, there was no penalty appeal at all, even though the VAR replays clearly showed that Kobayashi caught Kobayashi on the heel inside the box.
I haven't only seen the highlights myself. I'm not sure how it was played out in real time. I do think, how do I put it? I think personally, I'm still a fan of VAR. I think it's often the criticisms that it gets are sort of incorrectly directed. It's not the system, it's the way that the people who are using it do so, and it's the rules obviously that they are being told to follow. I think it's overused. I wonder if maybe it could be streamlined to be more like volleyball or something, where each team just gets a certain number of appeals per game. Referees make their decisions based on what they see, and if you want to appeal something, you get, I don't know, 5 per game, 3 per half or something, and then the manager or the captain can call the referee and ask them to look at something. Because I think that, yeah, I personally don't really like the rule, you touched upon it before, with Kikuchi's goal or not goal. I don't like the one where someone was impeding the goalkeeper's view. I think unless they're doing it on purpose, so what? There's 22 players out on the pitch. Sometimes someone's going to be in your way, and that's what happens. It's, you know, there's so many things that have an impact on a goal going in or not going in. I think if a striker is deliberately, or an attacking player, sorry, is deliberately blocking the goalkeeper's view, then fair play. If they just happen to be stood 10, 15 yards away from him and they're in his line of sight, then that's not really, I don't think, shouldn't really be taken into account. Some of the decisions, I think obviously this was a penalty. it was a clear penalty. It should have been given. So I don't know how long it took for them to come to the decision on this instance. But yeah, if it's a clear thing like this, I think it's good. I do wish that the referees and the video assistant referees would get quicker, because often you see the first replay and you pretty much know. And obviously there's been a lot of talk about if it's only a clear and obvious error. So that doesn't really seem to be taken into account anymore. They'll happily spend 3 or 4 minutes looking at something with minute detail, when maybe it was not, you know, the fact that they need that long means that it was not clear and obvious. But yeah, personally, I think I would probably say each team gets 2 or 3 per half, and it's up to them if you want to call for a review. Otherwise, you stick to the referee's decision and you keep playing. I think maybe that could be a happy middle ground.
All right, yeah, interesting shout there. Sam, I don't know whether I will have been able to squeeze the VAR drop in earlier on when we started talking about the Kikuchi incident. But, yeah, I mean, you tweeted at the time that, Kawasaki are going to have a penalty here. But it didn't occur to, any of the players on the pitch, or indeed the referee, because he wasn't, as I said, he was placing the ball in the middle of the D for the free kick to be taken by Frontale. But, the correct decision was made, but a bit of a head scratcher that, it's not a head scratcher that it took 5 minutes, because the J-League VAR decisions tend to take that long. But, I guess just puzzling that it wasn't given as a penalty in the first place, when you could see later on that the contact was clearly inside the box.
Yeah, I thought it was clear, and it would have been quite funny, actually, if there was a challenge system in place and Kawasaki cost themselves the title by not challenging this one, because, yeah, they weren't very interested for whatever reason. But, it took forever. I think it was like 4 or 5 minutes before they decided, and you can see from the first time you see it, it's in the area, so what they're doing, I don't know. But, yeah, it was a really weird one, but eventually the correct decision was made, and then young Tsuboi was so close to saving Ianaga's penalty. I thought he, considering the mess that was in front of him for a lot of the game, I thought he acquitted himself really well. Obviously, third choice goalkeeper with Ikura out, and probably for the best, and Maikara as well. But yeah, I thought he played really well. It looks like he's going to be in goal again against Yokohama on the final day, which, yeah, it should be a fantastic game, because Kobe on their day can beat anyone. They've already beaten Yokohama in the Asian Champions League, and final home game, they're going to be up for it to a degree, more than necessarily in any other game this season, and just like one that didn't necessarily matter. So yeah, it should be a fascinating one. You still think Marinos obviously in the driving seat, but with I think Kobe absolutely can beat them, so it leaves it all open. And I don't know if we could do the podcast next week if Kawasaki had won the league, winning 11-0 against FC Tokyo.
I'm prepared to cross that bridge when I come to it, but yeah, almost certain that won't happen. But following FC Tokyo, I would say stranger things have happened, but they haven't, but almost. Anyway, as we wrap up these two games for the top two, a number of their players are still in the race for the Golden Boot. Ianaga and Marcinho's goals on Saturday got them onto 12 and 11 respectively for the season. Ianaga is one behind Thiago Santana in the race for the Golden Boot. And from F. Marinos, Lopez's brace brought him onto 11 as well. That's the same number as his teammate Leo Ciara. And we're going to come on to the other player who's on 12 goals a little bit later. And his team had some good fortune. Well, they played well and won the game on Saturday down in the relegation dogfight. For Frontale, the equation is simple. They travel to FC Tokyo on the final day. If they win and Yokohama F. Marinos lose, they will be champions for the third straight season and the fifth time in 6 years. All right, let's get down and dirty in the dogfight. Gamba Osaka hosted Iwata in this week's relegation six-pointer, and a crowd of over 28,000 rocked up to the Panasonic Stadium, and they almost lived out their worst nightmare in the 59th minute when Yasuhito Endo, the Gamba Osaka legend, found himself free in front of goals 8 yards out after a square pass from Yuto Suzuki. All he had to do was slide the ball past Masaki Higashiguchi, but instead, maybe Endo took some pity on his former club and skied the ball into the stands. Gamba made the most of that reprieve, and in the 66th minute took a lead through Ryotaro Meshino, who took a pass from Yuki Yamamoto and after a mazy dribble slotted home to give Gumba the lead. And then Patrick, who had come on just before the hour, improvised a brilliant overhead kick from the penalty spot that grazed the fingertips of Ryuki Miura on its way in to seal Iwata's fate. Iwata are relegated to J2, but Sam, Gumba have given themselves hope, and as they head into the final match day, their fate is in their own hands as they sit in 15th place. That's safe as things stand.
Yeah, absolutely, and I've got a lot to thank Yasuhito Endo for. I mean, if he wasn't a legend already at Gambre, he definitely is now after that miss, because Iwata, I thought, was a better team going in up to that point, and if they took the lead in that there, I think Gambre could very easily have lost that game. I thought Iwata played very well. They took the game to Gambre as they had to. They had to win it. But yeah, that miss, just kind of confidence went after that, and Gambre improved, and yeah, they took their goals really nicely. Meshino's is a good finish, and then Patrick's an inspired choice for me in the old fantasy football. So it's perfect for Gambre. They had to win this game. You last two games, of one of them is Iwata, and yeah, they got themselves out of it. It's in their own hands. It's not going to, I mean, there's still so many moving parts at the bottom. It's not easy. Kashima away isn't, I mean, it could be. It wasn't easy for Shimizu, unfortunately. But yeah, it's not a guaranteed victory, that one, especially with Kyoto now playing against the relegated Iwata. So they're not home and hosed just yet, but this was vital for them. And the person most delighted, I think, is Kosuke Onose, because he missed an even worse than Endo. I think he was like 4 yards out when he fired over. So yeah, he'll be delighted with that victory, and it was a very important one for Gambre. For Iwata, they just didn't have that last fight back. They'd been able to keep themselves in so many games this season and grab late goals, but yeah, it was just a bridge too far for them. I think we've got to give a lot of credit to them for hanging in as long as they have, because I think they've got a very poor squad, and I do fear for them for the next next season with an aging squad, a transfer ban. I just think it's going to be a really difficult year for Iwata next season. But I think they've equipped themselves really well this season and fought hard. So it's a shame to see anyone go. But yeah, I think it was coming. It was long overdue, Iwata's relegation.
I guess so. Yeah, it seemed inevitable in recent weeks, Sean, even though they'd obviously given themselves some hope with that famous win away at F Marinos, and as I said, and I've mentioned a couple of times in the last few weeks, that failure to kill off that game at home against Kashima when they were 3-1 up, it's cost them the chance to take their survival chances into the final match day. But we can John and James can take care of Iwata next season. Sam said some nice words about them there, and they certainly did win some fans throughout the year for the way they were able to fight back into games. But it did look like it was going to be a long road to hoe for most of the second half of the season. So what of Gumba then? They're just about going to dig themselves out by the looks of things. Of course, they won't be counting any chickens, just a point ahead of Kyoto and three ahead of Shimizu with a game left. But they're going to have to sit down and make some huge decisions at the end of the day if they manage to survive, because again, this just hasn't been good enough. And if they do manage to escape, I imagine there'll be some huge changes at the Panasonic Stadium for next season.
I don't know if I would say they're safe yet. I think, there's this, looking at the five teams that could still go down or come in that playoff spot, and who they're playing on the last day of the season, nobody's in a game where you think they're guaranteed to win. And nobody's got a really, I don't think it's got a really difficult opponent either. So, I just think it still could go any of those five, I think. I still wouldn't be hugely shocked if they were to fall into one of those two spots available. Gamba, obviously, like so many teams, it just seem to be a bit of a mess. There just seems to be, we obviously spoke about Reds quite a bit earlier and what they're going to do next, but so many teams in J1 and obviously further down the pyramid too, just, they don't seem to have any kind of plan beyond the current season or the current 6-month period or whatever until the next transfer window. A lot of clubs I think need to try and work out what exactly it is they want to do and how they're going to do it. I mean, some of the players that Gamba have brought in recently, just there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. It's just either it's a Brazilian guy who's got a visa to be here in someone like Juan Alano, who, you know, nothing against him, he's not a bad player, but you know what him and Musashi Suzuki and obviously, you know, Meshino coming back to the club that he was at, and it just seems to be a hodgepodge of throw as much as you can at it and see what sticks. Which is why I kind of disagree a bit with Sam. I think this transfer ban, if Jubilo do end up having to follow one, could actually be good for them, because any club that is throwing money away on Kenyu Sugimoto and Jermaine Ryo and these kind of, just, you know, again, they're all better football players than I ever was. But I mean, really, when you looked at the squad ahead of the season, it didn't fill you with much optimism that this was going to be a team really able to challenge in J1. And I'm going to forget the guy's name now. Is it Yoshikawa who scored against Marinos?
Furukawa?
Furukawa. I do wonder if maybe having a transfer ban and having to give some of the, you know, the products coming through from the youth team, or, you know, the kind of the fringe players, the younger ones that maybe don't get many chances to play, instead of just dropping down, using any parachute payments to buy a few other 30-something year olds that have been around the block and maybe don't have the same motivation. You know, J2 as, you know, I'm sort of veering into to John's territory here, but this year it was so even. It was so, you know, there were sort of 10, 12 teams could still make the playoffs with, you know, a few rounds to go mathematically. So it's not that difficult. If you can build a decent team around motivated, talented players who are looking to make a mark, then I don't know, maybe a transfer ban could do them good. But yeah, as for Gamba, to return to your original question, I think, yeah, they obviously need to sit down over the off season, even if they do avoid the drop, and go, look, what exactly is it we're trying to do, and what type of football is it we want to play? Because right now it's just, yeah, it doesn't seem at all clear.
Yeah, they just haven't been able to go on any sort of a run as Kobe were able to do, and yeah, finally dig themselves out of danger and ultimately up to safety. But the permutations for the top two I was able to handle fairly comfortably earlier on in the podcast, but regular listeners will know, they're certainly not my strong point, permutations. But when it comes to the relegation dogfight, as Sean mentioned, there's five teams that could still finish, or basically between 13th and 17th, and for Gamba, they do have their fate in their own hands as they travel up to Kashima on the final day. They could finish as high as 13th, but could also slip as low as 17th and automatic relegation. If they lose, Kyoto get anything from their trip to Iwata, and Shimizu win away at Sapporo. So Gamba obviously far from safe heading into the final day, and their supporters will definitely be, I think, will be watching their game away at Kashima through their fingers. But ultimately, it was a positive result, of course, for Gamba, and as we said, they were able to finish the match day outside of the bottom three. More positive news came at the Lemon Gas Stadium, where Shonan hosted Tosu, and any nerves on the terraces at the Lemon Gas Stadium were quickly settled by Shuto Machino, the national team striker, stooping to head in Hirokazu Ishihara's cross into the top corner in just the 7th minute. And then 14 minutes later, Tariq El-Yanusi won the ball back 25 yards from goal, and Machino fired a terrific strike from inside the D past Park Il-gyu for 2-0 and his 12th goal of the season. So, yes, he, like Ianaga, is one behind Thiago Santana with one game left in the season. 2 minutes into the second half, Daiki Sugioka caught Jun Nishikawa on the edge of the box, and the referee awarded a penalty, but Belmare keeper Kosei Tani leapt to his right to save Nishikawa's spot kick, and Shonan's two-goal cushion remained intact. The points were wrapped up with 12 minutes left when Shuto Yamamoto headed in a Hiroyuki Abe corner. So Belmare winning 3-0, Sam, and 13th spot in the table, and that means they cannot be automatically relegated heading into the final day, and a lot of things would have to go against them for them to end up in 16th. So all things considered, a hugely satisfying afternoon in their final home game of the season for Belmare.
Yeah, I'd have to tell you, it would take some catastrophe, wouldn't it, for them to be into that relegation playoff, and even then everything's in their favour in that one. So, yeah, they'll be thinking they'll be in a very good position. I thought they played really well. They started fast. They started up and at Sagan Tosu, and they had no real answer for it. I mean, Machino's header, first of all, is fantastic, and his second goal, just as good. And it was his first start since the middle of September, which is very odd, and I've moaned about it a little bit before. But, yeah, you have him on the pitch, and you have Kosei Tani in goal. Those are two quality players that they'll be interesting to see if they can keep either or both of them next season. I'm sure, well, Gamba might look at Tani. We've been there before, and Machino might be a one that you think, oh, could he go back to Marinos and play there? Kawasaki looking for a new striker, could he be an answer there? But while they've got him, I think he's going to fire them to safety. I thought he was fantastic, and yeah, just it was a really positive performance from Shonan. They grabbed this game by the scruff of the neck and they've pretty much made themselves safe. So yeah, great for them. And Tosu were a nice opponent, I thought, though you want to play these kind of mid-table teams at this stage of the season. They didn't really get going. They might have done if they'd have scored that penalty at the start of the second half, but really, yeah, it was quite a comfortable victory for Shonan. So yeah, congratulations to them, and you should be able to get your yearly trip down to the Lemon Gas Stadium next season.
Yes, very relieved at that. Well, yeah, as I said, if things go horribly tits up for them on the final day, they could still finish 16th, but it's not looking that way heading into the final round. Now, Sean, of course, we were able to catch the Rodriguez news before we recorded the podcast on Monday, but very nice of Hajime Moriyasu to schedule his Japan World Cup squad announcement for lunchtime tomorrow, Tuesday. So, yeah, this podcast will not be released in time, basically, to catch and react to Moriyasu's squad. So I guess we could end up looking silly with egg on our face for the question I'm about to ask you. It wouldn't be the first time for me anyway. But, yeah, I don't think Moriyasu's the sort of man to be swayed by 90 minutes of football. But is there, what sort of a chance in percentage terms do you give Machino of making the Japan World Cup squad?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think Moriyasu has been naming the squads, and he's been naming goalkeepers, defenders, and then midfielders, forwards bunched into one. He doesn't really seem to pick that many centre forwards. I think Ayase Ueda is probably guaranteed, considering how he seems to have taken reasonably well to his move to Europe, and considering how much Kashima fell away after he left. Yuya Osako probably has played his way back in, and then with the likes of Daisei Maeda, Kyogo Furashi, I think there's enough players that are probably playing at a higher level more regularly, more consistently. Machino, obviously, Moriyasu obviously rates him reasonably because he took him to the East Asian Cup in the summer, and he did, you know, as well as you can do in that kind of slightly unusual competition. But I'd be surprised, because I just think, yeah, there's enough other players that can play in that position. And I mean, considering the quality of opposition Japan are coming up against, I mean, Osaka was in Europe for a while. Maeda Furuhashi are there now. Ueda is a player who's on the up, and has, you know, been playing at a more consistent and a higher level for longer than maybe Machino has. I do quite like Machino. I think he's a good player, but yeah, I don't think he's, if you've got 15 minutes to go against Germany or Spain at the World Cup and you're bringing on Shuto Machino, as lovely a story as it would be if he were to come on and do something, I think there are too many other options for him to take.
No, that's fair. So, Sam, have you scratched out a 26 recently? And if so, what do we know about Takuma Asano and Cole Itakura's fitness? And how many strikers, you know, he's going to name midfielders and forwards, which is infuriating for most of us. But how many, in inverted commas, strikers do you think he's ultimately end up going to pick?
I think it's going to be three or four, and not necessarily out-and-out strikers. Maeda will be a striker, but I think he's better on the wing. So I think it's Osako, Furuhashi, Maeda and Ueda. I think that's the way it's going to be. I think Machino needs an injury somewhere to get in. I think he hasn't done himself any harm. I think obviously a performance at the weekend. I think when he came on in that last bunch of friendlies, I think he did okay. I mean, none of the strikers covered themselves in glory in those fixtures, but I thought he did okay. But I think he's maybe a tournament too soon for him, especially if Osako comes back into it, because I think that's maybe his way in, because he's kind of a similar style of, or the most similar style of striker to an Osako than, well, for a Hashimaida, kind of different to Ueda. Likewise, as for the likelihood of Asano and Itakura, I know Asano is still hoped that he'll be fit for the World Cup. He hasn't played at all for Bochum since his injury. And likewise, Itakura, the manager said last weekend, I think it was, that the earliest he could return is the friendly against Canada. So it depends whether Moriyasu takes a gamble with either or both of their fitnesses. I would on Itakura, I wouldn't on Asano, just because of the amount of players in Asano's position. And yeah, you hope that Itakura can get through that Canada friendly and be fit. But yeah, both are touch and go, and neither of them are going to get any sort of club football before the World Cup.
All right, then. Interesting stuff. So, yeah, we won't go through and name our prospective 26s because, yeah, by the time you listen to this, it will have already been determined by Hajime Moriyasu, who is going to the World Cup for Japan. So, yeah, a number of players will have their fingers crossed as they go to bed tonight, Monday, and they'll find out their fate on Tuesday. But, well, I mean, we know from experience that Moriyasu likes his boys. And, yeah, you could probably name about 24 and 25 of the names off the top of your head anyway. So that's our quick national team interlude. We'll finish off the Shonan game by saying that, once again, they can't be automatically relegated, but they could, and they can only finish 16th if they lose on the final match day. Kyoto and Gamba both win, and Fukuoka gets something at Urawa, because those two are currently level on goal difference. So if Shonan lose and Fukuoka draw or better, theirs will be better than Shonan. Fukuoka also had a productive Saturday afternoon at home. They beat Kashiwa Reysol by a score of 2-1. And just like Shonan, they made a fast start to their must-win game against opponents with little to play for. Takaaki Shichi crossed from the left, and Yuya Yamagishi arrived in the centre to brilliantly drive home a half volley in just the fourth minute for his 10th goal of the season. And you could have won 500 yen off me in a bet, as I didn't think Yamagishi was anywhere near 10 goals this season. But that is a decent milestone for him in a season where, as we said earlier, the leader in the Golden Boot race has only 13 goals with one game to play. Then just before the break, Wanma was unmarked 6 yards out and powered home a pinpoint cross in from the right by Masato Yuzawa. 2-0 down at halftime, Nelsinho brought on midfielder Sachiro Toshima at the break, and it took him only 97 seconds to make an impact, smashing in a stunning rising pile driver from 25 yards to make things very nervy for the Fukuoka faithful. But they they hung on for basically the remainder of the game, the last 45 minutes of the game, as Fukuoka saw it out. And yes, just like Gamba and like Shonan, they have their fate in their hands heading into the final match day. And there were plenty of times late on in the season where it looked like that wasn't going to be the case for Fukuoka. So, Sean, they've given themselves a fighting chance on the final day. That's all their supporters could have asked for. And a game they had to win at home, their home finale, they got the job done.
Yeah, they did. I'm still disappointed with the way the season's gone. I think they've got definitely a better squad in terms of attack-wise than they had last season. And it's been quite disappointing to see how kind of conservatively they approach the year. I'd hope that maybe next year, if they do survive, that maybe they'll look at that and think, right, maybe we should try and play a bit more to the strengths that we've got, assuming obviously that they keep them all. In the J League, there tends to be so much activity in the off season because of a lot of players, you know, only being on 1 year contracts or on kind of, you know, rolling renewing contracts. But yeah, the things were looking pretty bleak a month, 6 weeks ago. So yeah, the fact they've managed to pull themselves to the brink of safety will be pleasing for their fans. But yeah, I think if you told them ahead of the season that this is the position they've been at, I don't think many of them would have been especially happy with that.
No, most definitely. So Reysol will be Shonan's opponents on the final day of the season, Sam, and they'd probably provide a sterner test for Belmare in their home finale than they did for Fukuoka on Saturday. But the little Sachiro Toshima was certainly a goal of the season contender, I think. Didn't waste any time at all making an impact in this game after coming on.
No, it was a great start to the half that they didn't have in the first half. And yeah, it was a terrific effort. He's kind of got that in his locker. I think I've seen a couple of times where he's produced from range. And this was it, kind of what was needed, actually, because once Avispa got that 2-0 lead, they're so good defensively with that back three. And they just haven't seen it very often this season that they've been ahead and had something to actually defend. So they needed that to get back into the game. Kashua, it was a very good strike. But after that, really, they didn't create too much. I thought Avispa were fairly fairly settled at the back. I don't think Kashua's movement was particularly great. There wasn't that urgency that there may have been earlier in the season. They've kind of been on the beach for the last couple of months after defying all expectations to be where they were and even where they are now. So yeah, I don't think they will give Shonan a bigger test on the final day just to celebrate their season in front of their home fans. But again, a bit like Tulsa, I thought this was the ideal opponent for Avispa. They've given themselves a really good chance. They go to Urara on the final day. Who knows what you're going to get from an Urara team? I don't know whether they'll give Rodriguez a fantastic send off or just to fall apart again. So yeah, it's an interesting one, but another one where Avispa have done really well, because maybe 6 weeks ago, I think they dropped into that relegation place and there was a real worry that they would never really get out of it. But they've managed to rebound. They've scored a couple of goals. They've been a bit more attacking. Yamagishi has done really well this season to get the goals that he has. So, yeah, I think great for Avispa. And I know we've got a lot of Avispa supporters in the community, so it's good that they're doing well. And fingers crossed for them that they can survive on the final day.
Indeed, indeed. So, like Shonan, Avispa can't be automatically relegated, but they could finish 16th if they lose to Urawa, Kyoto win, and also Gamba win. Actually, a Gamba draw and a Fukuoka loss by two goals would be enough, I think. But again, I'm terrible at permutations. So, we'll cross that bridge if we come to it. All right, Sean, I think we might have to be a little bit of a support group here for Sam after Shimizu's latest. I don't want to call it a horror show, because they were good at times against Kashima, but they just couldn't make the breakthrough in the first half. But no gloating, please, from you after your boyfriend, Kento Misao, ultimately broke S-Pulse hearts 11 minutes into the second half. First things first, the situation is beyond dire for S-Pulse now.
Yeah, I wouldn't dream of gloating. He did. I did message him. I hadn't actually been in touch with him for quite a while, but I did message him and say, congratulate him on his goal. And he did admit that it was a little bit lucky. I still think the strike before it was pretty good, though, for a defensive midfielder / centre back. He really caught the first shot. I think he bought that bit of luck. Shimizu, it's odd, isn't it? So there was that point after they changed the manager when it really looked like they'd turned a corner and were really sort of streaking away up to the middle of the table. It's equally bizarre that they're, it could be a Shimizu player who ends the year as top scorer and they get relegated. And obviously with Shuto Machino up there, just a goal behind him as well, with Shonan still not completely safe. It's slightly odd this year that the goals, someone who's far more interested in, far more knowledgeable about the statistical side of things, will probably look at the way that teams at the top of the table play and how they use their five subs and share the goals around, maybe. But yeah, it's interesting that the top scorers are down there. But yeah, for Shimizu, they're just not getting the breaks. And as I touched upon earlier, with the fact that the title is in Marinos' hands, but as the pressure builds, you don't know how players are going to react. And it seems to have been similar for Shimizu, whereas Avispa had that blip and then managed to pull themselves out of it with a few games to spare. Shimizu looked to be safe, and then they've fallen into this spiral. And it's with each week you just sort of get further and further down into the abyss. And now it's gone down to the very end. And even if they win, they're not guaranteed of safety. So not looking good for them at all.
No, and yeah, another frustrating afternoon on the terraces at Nihon Daira, Sam. Their team created numerous chances in the first half, but as I said, they just weren't able to make the breakthrough. Antlers keeper Tomoki Hayakawa was kept busy, but yeah, was equal to the task. And yeah, when he wasn't saving chances, the S-Pulse players were sending them either high or wide. So yeah, I guess when they went in at halftime, they will have yeah, been feeling the pressure, feeling the nerves of not making their advantage in the first half count. And then yes, just like Kento Misao, isn't it, to go and spoil any sort of yeah, a chance for S-Pulse to get something from the game. So what can you say about your boys? It's very much last chance saloon time on the final day now.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, when you're down there, things aren't going to go for you. You need the lucky break. You don't need a block tackle to loop in and go into the back of your own net. It was a little bit unfortunate, but Shimizu had their chances first half. The finishing wasn't good enough. They didn't make the breakthrough. And after they went 1-0 down, there was no response at all. Yeah, Kashima got good players and they're a decent team on their day. But even so, with the position that Shimizu are in, you expect a response. And there wasn't really anything. I mean, they've had so many times, like, they're almost safe at one stage, and then they got deer in the headlights, and they've panicked every time they've gone ahead. They've gone to defend, and then they've ended up losing games or drawing games at the end. Like, that one against Iwata last week, to concede as late as they did in a game, absolutely must win against your rival. I mean, I think it's kind of knocked the stuffing out of them. And this one as well will do. It's looking really difficult for them. Maybe they can say the pressure's off. They go against Sapporo, which is going to be a shootout. You imagine the way that Sapporo play, the way, no sort of pressure on them. They'll go out and enjoy themselves. Shimizu are going to have to win. It should be a great game for the neutral. Maybe they can come out on top in a 3-2, something like that, and go out and play it. But yeah, it's looking desperate for them. Best case scenario, I think maybe they can get out. I think it's unlikely, but if they can get into that playoff and maybe play Yamagata, I think Johnny mentioned it last week, play Yamagata, have their striker ineligible against his parent club, then it might be the reprieve that Shimizu want. But yeah, it's looking dodgy, and I'm not good enough at DIY, I don't think, to repair this bandwagon, so I might have to call in some extra help. But yeah, it's looking like they might be down in J2, and I just have to, maybe I'll pick Albirex and have a different team in orange.
All right, well, yeah, so Shimizu head to Sapporo on the final day, having not won in 6 games. But again, this is the J-League, so anything is possible. And who knows, they might end up 15th at the end of match day 34. Who knows? The first things first, they must win or they're automatically relegated, S-Pulse. A win will not even be good enough, as Sean mentioned earlier, if a Gumba draw or win and a Kyoto win. Again, there's some more permutations, but basically, yeah, Shimizu can win and find out what happens in the other games. They could possibly, but very unlikely, finish as high as 15th. But yeah, first things first, just win the game, S-Pulse, and may the chips fall where they may. All right, so the last game that we'll cover that involved a dog fighter, and the last one we'll cover before we let Sean get on with the rest of his evening and try and recover from his cold, is at the Sanga Stadium, where Kyoto hosted Cerezo Osaka. So there was interest in at both ends of the table in this game. The race for third, if that is indeed a thing, between Hiroshima and Cerezo, and a healthy crowd of over 17,600 rocked up to the Kyoto Stadium, and they ended up seeing no goals, but no shortage of drama. And yeah, an end-to-end, a literal game of two halves, but yeah, both teams had their periods of dominance in this game. And well, yeah, towards the end, the Kyoto goal definitely led a charmed life, but in the 94th minute, with the second to last kick of the game, Kyoto's player Daigo Araki had the chance to be a hero and well, basically seal the fact that Kyoto could not be automatically relegated. But his blast from alongside the penalty spot was blocked out for a corner by Kakeru Funaki, the Cerezo defender, throwing in a heroic block, and it finished 0-0 somehow, Sam. I don't know how. This was it looked a terrific game, and it deserved a goal or two or three, but ultimately didn't have any.
Yeah, as nil-nils goes, this is probably one of the best you'll see. I thought Kyoto, like, a bit like Avispa and Shonan, started really well. They put a lot of pressure on Cerezo. They just didn't get the breaks. Ogiwara hit the post. There were shots blocked. There was some heroic defending from Cerezo at times, and Kim made a couple of saves. And it just wasn't quite going for Kyoto at that stage. But then, as the game unfolds, they got a lot quite lucky at the other end, and they have a lot to thank their goalkeeper Kari Fukumoto, who knew the pole was going this week for Kyoto and was making a late push. I thought he made some tremendous saves, the one pushed onto the bar from Jean Patrick, various others, and in the end they just got away with it a little bit. Well, until the final actors that you mentioned with Araki, where they could have nicked it. So in the end, I think they'd probably just escape through the point and then might just be happy given the way that ended. But yeah, it was a really exciting game. Both teams could have won it. But yeah, I think man of the match without doubt was Kami Fukumoto.
Yes, indeed. So, well, I guess the final word from you on this podcast, Sean, the Kyoto supporters will hope it's not a final word on them for this season, because, yeah, they're obviously giving themselves a fighting chance to stick around in J1 next season. Again, a limited squad, but they've Chokwije has squeezed out pretty much as he could from it. And, yeah, again, they had a dicey spell where it looked like automatic relegation might have been on the cards. So the fact that they travel to Iwata, who are, as we know, automatically relegated now, means they have a chance to win for the first time in four games on the final match day, and that could see them finish as high as 13th.
Yeah, I think to throw out one positive and one negative, I think I said earlier about Avispa how their fans wouldn't have been happy to have this situation if you told them that's what it would be ahead of the season. I think for Kyoto fans, they probably would have taken it. Yeah, they came up with a vastly changed squad, and yeah, lots of new faces, lots of unproven names at J1 level. So to still be in, yeah, the worst case scenario is you've got a playoff at home against a J2 team that you don't have to beat. You just have to not lose to. I think they would have taken that ahead of the season. On the less positive side, I think Jubilo were relegated. But it so often happens in Japan that when teams don't have anything to play for, when they don't have any pressure, they suddenly relax and play better and get a result. So that might just be something that Kyoto would need to be wary of. If the pressure was on Jubilo as well, maybe you'd have a kind of a more tense game where Jubilo know they can't afford to take any risk. But I mean, you're already relegated. So it's your last home game of the season. Why not, throw everything you've got at the game and see what happens? So, Kyoto will be a bit wary of that. Again, even if they lose, it's still not guaranteed that they would be in the... No, it would be, wouldn't it? If they lose, they're guaranteed the playoff? Or is it... No, it's dependent on Gamba, right?
Well, if they lose and Shimizu win, then they'll finish below Shimizu and they'll be relegated automatically. So
right, okay. Yeah, you've got these permutations. So yeah, I think there's a little bit more pressure on Kyoto in that they've still got something to play for. Jubilo can just go in and kind of last day of the season thank their fans and see what happens. Yeah, obviously that may work to Kyoto's advantage. You'd think, looking at it rationally, it should do, but yeah, just it seems to happen, as I said, in Japan a lot, that once the pressure's off, teams just play better. You see it so often as well in a kind of smaller scale where, a team's hanging on, can't quite get the equaliser. They concede the second goal and then they pull one back in the 93rd minute and you're kind of like, well, couldn't you have done that a bit earlier and made a game of it? Now it's too little too late. So, yeah, Chokwije will be wary of that. He's not the kind of coach who tends to take risks. He tends to set up to keep things solid, work hard, press the opponent and try to eke out goals where they'll come from. So, yeah, but I think Kyoto fans would have taken that ahead of the season, and they'll be quietly confident just because there's so many other permutations. Shimizu would have to win as well, and there's other teams that could also get drawn down into it. But personally, I think Kyoto will probably be all right. By which I mean, I think, yeah, the worst case scenario will be that playoff, which I think, yeah, is so heavily weighted in the favour of the the J1 team that, yeah, not too much to worry about.
Yeah, all right then. So Kyoto, another of Yasuhito Endo's former teams, of course. I wonder if he'll go as easy on them if he gets a chance from 8 yards out as he did Gumba this past Saturday. But yes, we'll wait and see. And yeah, so much to play for still in the dogfight, obviously, with five teams still with their futures undecided heading into the final round of the season. As we said, Kyoto could finish as high as 13th, but also as low as 17th if they lose and Shimizu win up at Sapporo. All right then, Sean, you battled through with us for 7 of the 9 games from the match day, so we very much appreciate that. The listeners are probably crying out for me to try and pin you down for some predictions, but as I said, you're fighting through a cold and we want you to come back again in the future, so I won't stress you out too much. But
how about I give you my 26? How about I tell everyone what the 26 was?
Maybe we could make that a Patreon exclusive. I don't know. Well, anyway, we'll leave it there, and again, thank you very much for your time, and enjoy the final match day. Actually, where are you going to go? Because I suppose you're going to go to Ajinomoto.
Yeah, I probably have to. I was kind of tempted to go to Kashima, just because, you know, there's the Gamba is still not completely safe, and I do feel like Marinos will get it done, and I just think, yeah, being at Todoroki is, but there's obviously still the chance that it won't happen. So I think I have to be at the Frontale game. I remember back in, was it the first year Frontale won? Was it when Antlers were away at Jubal? I think it was 2017.
Yep, that's right.
And I'm going to do a terrible name drop now, but I remember after the second to last fixture, I think Frontale had played Reds away, and I asked a couple of the Frontale players, where do they recommend I should go on the last day? Should I go to Yamaha or should I be at Todoroki for their game? And I asked a couple of the Brazilian players, I forget who now, I've got a feeling it was El Senio was still there then, and they kind of laughingly said, yeah, you have to come to Todoroki. And then I asked Kengo, and he seemed a bit put out by the question. He kind of looked to me as if it was kind of a weird question to ask, and he just said, I can only say Todoroki. And then a few of the other journalists weren't happy with me because he sort of walked off afterwards and the interview ended. And then I did go to Todoroki. I forget who they played now. Who did they beat on the last day?
Was it Omiya? Like 5-0 or something?
Oh, possibly. That sounds like something Omiya would do, doesn't it? I forget who they played. But anyway, I did go to Todoroki. And obviously, Kashima didn't get the win they needed away against Jubilo. Frontale did. And then I was sort of hanging around in the mix zone afterwards. Kengo came out to do the TV interview, and he saw me and sort of pointed him and, oh, you came here. I told you, or something like that. So I feel like, I should learn from that and realize that, you never know with the J League where there's a chance. I'm supposed to be going, but I'm now rambling on.
That's
and
fine,
I do
mate.
Remember the year that Kawasaki stopped Marinos from winning it, which I think was 2014. 13 or 14.
I'm going to go with 13, I think.
It was one of those. And I was still writing for the Daily Yomiuri then. And I told my editor I wanted to go to Kashima because I felt that Kashima were going to win it because Marinos had choked in that game against Niigata the week before.
Mm.
And seeing the players and the coach afterwards, they just looked shot. They looked like they knew that was it because they had to go away to Frontale the next week. And I said to my editor, I wanted to go to Kashima to see. I thought that San Frecce were going to win the league. And they told me, no, we want you to go to, you know, the team that's top. Because even if Marinos don't win, it's still a story. And then, I went to Todoroki and San Frecce won 2-0 away at Kashima and won the league. So, very, very long answer to your question. But I'll probably be at Ajinomoto, to see the 11-0 or 12-1. 12-1
Very gracious of you to give us a goal there. Thank you very much. Yeah.
It'll be an own goal by Kurumaya if you have to come on for it.
Oh, terrific stuff. All right, yeah, well, rock up to Agister and see some J-League history on Saturday. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
good stuff, good stuff. All right, well, yeah, great to catch up with you again, Sean. And, yeah, we look forward to doing so again, well, early next season, I hope.
Yeah, fingers crossed, yeah. Look forward to it. Thanks a lot, mate.
All right, thanks again to Sean Carroll. So after a quick hit of music, Sam and I will wrap up the other two games from Match Day 33 and hand out some more Player of the Season awards. Welcome back. So, yes, two games left to review from Match Day 33. The first one we'll cover was down at the Edion Stadium in Hiroshima, where host Son Freche might have been excused for having a Levain Cup hangover. Of course, they had won their first ever cup title the previous weekend over Sadezo Osaka. And, yeah, they hosted a Sapporo side who were looking to seal their J1 status for next season. As it turned out, other results went for Sapporo, and they didn't have to win, but they did anyway. In the 11th minute, the Hiroshima keeper Keisuke Osako kept out a close-range Shinzo Kuroki volley, but in the 23rd minute, Kuroki raced on to a lovely Lucas Fernandez through ball, shifted the ball past Osako, and slotted home the second all-time top scorer in J1. Certainly rolled back the years on Saturday, Sam. This was approaching a vintage Kuroki performance. A number of chances, and yeah, this was an excellently taken goal.
You've stolen my exact phrase. So, but it was absolutely. I thought rolling back the years, Kuroki. We haven't seen enough of it this season for Sapporo. Yes, he's had quite a few injuries, and yeah, age is catching up to him. But when he turns it on like this, yeah, it's just a flashback, isn't it, to the great Shinzo Kuroki. It was a really well taken goal, and I just thought Sapporo just played really well. And yes, maybe there was a hangover from Hiroshima, but they played very nicely. A lot of through passes. They carved open Hiroshima really well. Kuroki's movement here was very good and ably supported by Xavier behind him, Aoki as well, and then Fernandez and Kaneko either side. I thought it was a really good performance from Sapporo, and they started off really well. They're one of those teams that, if they've got nothing to play for, they are one of the dangerous ones, because if they play with freedom, they are going to be attacking, they're going to be open, they're going to create a lot of chances, and they did that against him. Hiroshima side, who don't usually concede too many chances, and all this did was worry me for next week and their game against Shimizu.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, it certainly doesn't bode well for S-Pulse, does it? Sapporo able to play with the handbrake off, and excellent here against Son Freche, who we should say did equalise 8 minutes before the break. Gatsuto Notsuda, one of their best players this season, turned in a cross from Tsukasa Shiotani with the outside of his left foot to equalise, a terrific finish. But Fernandez set up the first, and he had a role to play in the second as well. And we might be talking a little bit more about him in a few minutes. An arrowed ball into the box from deep on the left by Fernandez was headed back across goal by Gabriel Xavier, with Hiroki Miyazawa able to chest down before shooting past Osako from close range. So, that's J1 survival wrapped up for Sapporo. It was in very little doubt, but yes, they extinguished any doubt at all with this victory. Hiroshima, well, they were able to hang on to a third spot. Well, they would have anyway at kickoff, but yes, their advantage over Cerezo was reduced by just a point after Cerezo's draw away at Kyoto. So, Hiroshima are 3 points and 4 goals of goal difference ahead of Cerezo in the race for third. Hiroshima travel to Tosu on the final day, while Cerezo host Nagoya, who we're coming on to next. Grampus hosted FC Tokyo in the only game that had literally nothing riding on it on Saturday. And, Noriyoshi Sakai's close-range header gave hosts Grampus the lead in just the 10th minute. And the final 2 goals of this game were scored by players against their former club. For FC Tokyo, Yasuki Kimoto fired in from 20 yards 4 minutes into the second half to make it 1-1. But with about 20 minutes left, Grampus took a quick free kick down the right. Ryoya Morishita crossed from the right. Jakub Slovic, the Tokyo keeper, got a hand to it. But Kensuke Nagai was free at the back post to tap in, and that was the final goal of the game. Grampus winning 2-1 over FC Tokyo. Yeah, not a lot to say here, Sam, but I guess a couple of sweet moments for players against their former clubs. You mentioned you got Patrick into your fantasy team. Was that at the expense of Nagai?
No, Nagai was there as well. I needed both of them, really, because I've got Alex Bishop and Scott McIntyre both breathing down my neck towards the end of this season. So, yeah, Nagai is still there. He's been a revelation since his move back to Nagoya. It just, I don't know what it is. It didn't really work for him at Tokyo for a large part, especially towards the end. But, yeah, he's moving quite well. He's getting into good positions. So he was helped out here by Tokyo not deciding to defend that quick free kick. They were caught out, and Slovic does his best, but not couldn't turn it away from Nagai, and he was in the right place at the right time. So, yeah, perfect for him. It was a decent enough game, considering there was little on it. I mean, Tokyo could have won this and then have been 2 points away from third, but let's not think about that if you're an FC Tokyo supporter. They probably don't want to be in the ACL next season. Just settle for sixth and build from there. But it was a reasonable game. Kumoto's goal, probably the highlight, a really good finish and not really something you expect to see from him. So, decent parts of this game. It was very watchable, but in the end, very little meaning to it.
No, fair enough then. So, sweet for Nagai to score the winner, and indeed for the Grampus manager, Kenta Hasegawa, to, get the 3 points against his most recent employers. All right, well, speaking of Nagoya and indeed Sapporo, they were two of the clubs whose players our patrons voted on in their latest JTOOK Player of the Season polls. And we'll do them in the order they were posted late last week. So the first one was Grampus. Four players were nominated and a total of 16 votes cast. 12 of those went to Mateus Castro, their offensive talisman. No surprise, I think, from Sam and myself to see Mateus run out a clear winner ahead of goalkeeper Mitch Langerak and Yuki Sorma, who is on the fringes of Hajime Moriyasu's World Cup squad. And we'll obviously find out on Tuesday whether Sorma's name will be called or not. According to our patrons, a clear winner in the shape of Mateus, Sam. But we did have an interesting comment come in from Graham Freche, who thought that Leo Silva should have been at least nominated and would have been his choice for Grampus Player of the Season. So I guess I better give you the right of reply, as you were basically in charge of putting our lists together.
Yeah, I think it's an ongoing theme that me and Graham Freche don't agree on anything when it comes to the J-League, except maybe Kakitani. I think we had common ground there and I'm not great favour for Kakitani. But I wouldn't have had Leo Silva there. You could maybe argue, I think Inagaki came out with no votes in this. Maybe you could argue they could be interchangeable. But he's 36 now. He's been subbed off very early in most games. He's dropped for three of the last four, and I think his best days are behind him. At his best and at his peak at Niigata and Kashima, a magnificent player, one of the best foreign imports into the J-League. But I don't think Nagoya this season have seen the best of him. I think there's no doubt in my mind that Mateus was the clear winner. The only surprise I had was that people voted for anyone other than Mateus. I think he has been completely their talisman in outside of his favoured position for much of it. Some of the goals he scores is just superb. His delivery from set pieces and when he goes out wide is just undefendable at times. And I think we'll come to a poll that was even wider than this one at Shonan. But for me, Mateus was the most clear outright winner for this. So, I'm surprised. I'm not surprised that Graham Freche disagrees with me. That's the way he is and absolutely entitled to his opinion. But I am firmly in camp Mateus.
Yes, as am I. Always the player that you fear the most when you're a fan of an opposing team playing against Grampus. And, he's their best player and has been again this season, in my opinion. So, Mateus wins the Grampus Player of the Season. And it might surprise some that this is the first time he's won this award during his time at Nagoya. The previous two seasons, Sho Inagaki and Mitch Langerak had taken the honours as the JTOOK Player of the Season. So, a first-time recipient, Mateus, and very well-deserved after his excellent 2022 season. All right, then, so we'll move on to Sapporo. who obviously had a very fruitful Saturday afternoon as well, winning away at Hiroshima. Four nominees here, and the votes were interestingly spread. A total of 10 votes cast, but we did get some postal votes from both Johnny and Tom suggesting that Lucas Fernandez and or Ryota Aoki should have been options in our poll. I mean, we have been limiting it to four players, Sam. And yes, it's a game of opinions. And in our opinion, the four nominated players were Sapporo's best. And ultimately, it's turned out that Daiki Suga got 4 of the 10 votes to edge out the goalkeeper Takenori Sugano, who got 3. Shunta Tanaka and Tomoki Takamine also were among the votes. But I guess we should respond to Johnny and Tom's suggestions of Lucas and Aoki.
Yeah, absolutely. This was perhaps the most difficult one, as the votes have suggested, with it being completely spread across them. It was a really difficult one to get narrow this down to 4. I think I'll hold my hands up. I think Lucas Fernandez should be in there on reflection, and maybe that is being swayed by his performance at the weekend as well. But yeah, he's had a fantastic season over on both sides, both at wing back. I think he's played really well, absolutely. And yeah, I can understand completely why Johnny and Tom both want Lucas in there. Aoki, I think he's their top scorer, but it's only with 6, so it's not like a standout case. And like there are so many like players very similar to Aoki in that side, and I just think he's okay, but he never really stands out to me as like, well, Ryota Aoki's playing here, I've got to watch this. So yeah, maybe he could have been in as a 4th or 5th choice, maybe. But yeah, I'll stand by Aoki not being in there. I think Lucas Fernandez probably should. But either way, I don't think anyone would have won it for me. I voted for Suga, which I know that takes it over Sugano, and it's a difficult one. So if you want to go for Sugano, I wouldn't have many arguments with you, because he's been fantastic all season. They obviously very highly work to Sapporo because they don't defend too often, and he's had to pull out so many saves. But I think Suga, the way that he's been able to play in various positions, like he started his life as a striker, but he's now been made into a wing back, also plays at centre back because of Fukumori's deteriorating form. And I think he's just slotted in so well in both of those roles. I think he's been very consistent. He scored some incredible goals as well from long range. So I just think, yeah, his overall work ethic and consistency of performance is why I would pick him. But yeah, as I say, if you want to go differently, because it's such a tight vote, I don't think this is one where we have to absolutely rubber stamp it if you want to go another way.
Yeah, I was thinking of siding with Sugano, but then again, I checked the numbers, and I mean, it's interesting in the fact that we've nominated 3 defenders, well, 2 defenders and a goalkeeper from a team that has the second worst defense in the league in terms of goals conceded. But again, that's just obviously a byproduct of Misha Petrovic's system. And I guess the defenders and the goalkeeper get so much coverage because they're often so exposed. I guess at the end of the day, I don't feel strongly enough about Sugano to sway it in his direction. I mean, you literally watch their games in full every week. And while Sugano often looks absolutely terrific on the highlights, flying here, there and everywhere to try and make saves and I guess keep his team in games. I appreciate the quality that Suga brings and the versatility as well. So I mean, we haven't really done too much controversial throughout these polls, have we, so far, Sam? And yeah, I'm not really prepared to stake a claim for Takenori Sugano. So I think we'll go with Suga. We'll let the patrons have their win. And he was your choice as well. So I'm happy to go along with that. Good reward, just reward for a fine season from the versatile Consadole man. All right, well, there was no doubt at all in the Sean and Belmare poll. Straight down the middle, Sam, 10 votes cast, all of them for Shuto Machino, 100%. And I think that's the first time that's happened in J-Talk Player of the Season poll history. So we'll take a bow, Shuto, and it's thoroughly deserved, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. A complete walkover and very much deserved. The goals that he scored, I think it's 12 so far in 29 games. He's got himself into the national team, playing at a team struggling in Shona. I think he's had a fantastic season, absolutely deserves it. Maybe could have seen one or two votes for Tani in this, but really there was no other option, was there? Machino has been magnificent. As I said before, it's going to be interesting to see if Shonan can keep him, even if they do stay up, or whether he sees his future higher in the league. It's going to be definitely a good grab, I think, for one of those teams if they do look to get Machino. But yeah, just as an all-round striker, I think he adds a little bit of everything. His goals are all a little bit different. He's obviously good in the air, but both, yeah, his footwork is good. He can hold the ball up. He can run past players. He's just, yeah, it's been a really great breakout season for him, and yeah, as deserving as anyone would be for one of these awards.
Yep, so all we can do is rubber stamp that. The patrons have got that absolutely bang on, and yeah, well done to Shuto Machino, and yeah, thoroughly deserved, no questions asked. Along similar lines to the Sapporo poll, the fourth and final poll of the week for Kyoto was very, very tight indeed. Not too many patrons getting involved in this one, just 9 votes cast, but yes, it was quite close between Sota Kawasaki, who got 44% of the vote, the goalkeeper Naoto Kami Fukumoto 33%, and Peter Utaka 22%. So we're trying to do some math on the fly. I reckon that means Kawasaki got 4 votes, Kami Fukumoto 3, and Utaka 2. And there you go. I didn't major in maths at university for nothing, listeners. All right then. So yeah, this is a tight one. I tell you what, Sam, I'll go first here, and I'm actually going to I'm going to plump for Kami Fukumoto. I'm happy for you to overrule me. I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit, won over by his, display in the 0-0 with Cerezo on Saturday, when he was flying all over the place. And indeed, yeah, tipping that header from John Patrick onto the bar. Some of his acrobatics were absolutely stunning. I know he's got he's got a mistake in him. There's no question about that. But I guess, a lesser goalkeeper. I reckon they might have already been relegated by now, Kyoto. So I would plump for him. Kawasaki was the choice of the patrons, and quite possibly of you yourself. I don't know. But obviously, if we're doing this at the halfway point of the season, Utaka might have been unanimous as Machino was. But his second half of the season obviously makes it difficult to choose him. So it's between Kawasaki and Kami Fukumoto. I would slightly give the edge to the keeper. Or what say you?
I don't. Did you put your vote in on the app, or is yours not counted?
No, I didn't vote in this one. I actually only voted in one of the polls so far. I've tried to stay Switzerland on them.
Okay, well, if you take mine out, then it would be level, so we could have an interesting... Because I did go for Kawasaki. As you say, I think Utaka would have swept it at the halfway stage, but I think he was part of that COVID cluster and really hasn't recovered from it. So not really played too many games, so hopefully he's okay. I know there's rumours that he might be retiring at the end of this season, hopefully he's okay, because he's not been the same since that. But, Kami Fukumoto on his day has been fantastic. He's kept Kyoto in many games, and probably has had his day more often than not this season. So I completely get why he would be voted for. There are a few occasions where he was a bit dodgy, but I just thought, when I looked at Kyoto this season, I've not really seen a lot of Kyoto before, but the one player that stood out to me is, again, this guy is J1 quality, and that was Sota Kawasaki. I just think he runs that midfield, and he's so clever with his movement, so clever with the way he moves the ball, and a lot runs through Kawasaki. So he was my pick, but maybe I've swayed this vote with the by voting for it, because it would have been 33, well, level between him and Kami Fukumoto, and I'm not against Kami Fukumoto winning this. So I think I overrule too often, so I think Kami Fukumoto, I'll allow you to allow Kami Fukumoto to win this one.
All right, okay. Well, a bit of love for the goalkeepers. I mean, they don't tend to win too many of these polls. There were a few votes for Langerak and Sugino obviously earlier, but they don't tend to win the day too often. So good for Kami Fukumoto, to win this accolade. Quite a journeyman by this point in his career, but this is definitely something he can put on his mantelpiece at home and display to his friends and family. So well done, Naoto, the Kyoto player of the season for 2022. And I should give a thanks that I forgot to do in the post on Patreon. A thanks to Nick Bolton for his help in putting that list together as well. Imagine, Nick, his fingernails will be bitten down to the quick with just one game to go. But hopefully for him and all Sanga supporters, they can secure safety away at Iwata on Saturday, when, yes, the final match day of the season will be played at match day 34, all games kicking off at 2 o'clock. So obviously the title will be won either at the Noivu Stadium in Kobe or at Ajinomoto Stadium in Tokyo, when the F Marinos visit Kobe and Frontale visit FC Tokyo. So, all eyes will be on those two grounds, but also on the remainder of the relegation dogfight. We've obviously given you the fixtures throughout this episode. But, Sapporo versus Shimizu, I think, is much-watch TV. S-Pulse fans obviously will be fearing the worst as they head up there, but all they can do is go for it. Gamba as well, away at Kashima. Fukuoka travel to Reds. Shonan are at Kashiwa, and Kyoto away at already relegated Iwata, while the other two games are Cerezo hosting Nagoya and Tosu entertaining Hiroshima. So either Cerezo or Hiroshima will end up finishing third. And hard to believe the end of the season is almost here, Sam, but so much still to play for on Saturday in the final round. And can't wait for it, but it's going to be just fascinating for so many reasons.
Yes, so many games have so much riding on them. I think it's a really interesting quirk that Barca-Reza, we really don't have that much to play for. Everyone involved in the tight race or the dogfight is away from home. So then no one's got home support that they can maybe bank on or have that pressure on them, who knows. But every time these final days, something is thrown up, something wild happens. I can't call it, whichever it might be. We might have a shock title win, we might have a shock relegation. Either way, it's going to be really exciting, and I can't wait for it. And I look forward to wrapping it up next week. And good luck to everyone. We have no real dogs in this. Maybe you do against Kawasaki, I suppose. But as much as I am on the Shimizu bandwagon, I am completely neutral in terms of relegation. So may the best team win.
Yes, indeed. Well said. I mean, if Kawasaki can rock up and win 11-0 or 12-1, as Sean suggested, fair dues, that they deserve it. But we'll wait and see. Fascinating match day in progress, prospect at both ends of the table, no question. All right, then. So that's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would obviously like to thank Sean Carroll again for his time in part one of this week's episode. We'd like to thank all of our patrons for their ongoing support and indeed for voting in our polls again this week. Just four more to come for your patrons in the end of this week before the final match day is played. The last four clubs that we have to do before we round up the final match day in next week's episode. And then, patrons, if you thought these polls were something, just hang on, because, we've still got to do our team of the season, of course. So they will be following the week after the season wraps up. So, that's it then. Again, thanks to you for listening wherever you are. And we'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 34. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.